Is working in management consulting as glamorous as it seems? What's the best thing you can do to improve your public speaking skills? How can you use different pricing strategies to scale up your business? Welcome back to How They Get Stuff Done. Today I'm speaking with Judson Rollins. Judson is an aviation strategy consultant and a monetization architect for expert service providers who want to decouple their revenue from their hours. Judson and I discuss finding the middle ground between perfection and acceptability, the pros and cons of time blocking, Judson's favorite ways to capture ideas on the go and even in the shower, and more. Enjoy the conversation. Hey, Judson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So, Judson, you and I met at Toastmasters, a big international public speaking organization, and we met at one of the clubs in Amsterdam. So I guess we both better be really, really eloquent during this conversation.
I would certainly hope so.
Otherwise, something went wrong.
Someone from the club will reach out and whack us both over the head.
Exactly, exactly. Actually, I don't know. How did you come to know about Toastmasters?
So Toastmasters, because it's an international organization, has been on my radar for a long time. Mm. And when I lived in the U.S. and New Zealand, for various reasons, I never joined. And when I moved to Amsterdam, one of the ways that I thought about making friends was, hey, you know what? I think it's time for me to polish up my public speaking abilities. And because I worked in the airline industry prior to the COVID or coronavirus pandemic, I was used to appearing at conferences, being on panels, right, being a moderator. And so before the pandemic, I had plenty of opportunities to speak. But when you moderate over Zoom, it's not the same experience.
The
you
same.
Can't tell if you're bombing or if you're actually connecting with the audience. And so my skills really atrophied, and I realized I need to get back in the arena, so to speak, and start polishing up those speaking abilities again.
Yeah. You know, it gets me thinking of, I ran an online course recently where I took a group of about 30-something people through a program to get organized and be more productive, and we'd meet on Zoom a couple times a week. And what you said resonated so much. Sometimes, you know, I'd be teaching, and then people, just their faces are like, I'm not enjoying this at all, you know, or like people appear not to be paying attention. And then
if they even have their camera on.
Yeah, if they even have their camera on, which I always encourage people to do. And then afterwards, I was like, how did you like it? And everybody was like, it was great. I learned so much. Amazing. And I was like, wait a second. Well, couldn't you smile then?
Wait, what? Where was this during the session?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So would you recommend Toastmasters then for people who want to get into public speaking and perhaps make friends?
100%. Especially if you live in a larger city, there's bound to be multiple clubs. And find a group of people, find a Toastmasters club that has a group of people you like and you feel like you resonate with, and you feel like their speeches resonate with you. Find your tribe, find your group. But yeah, Toastmasters is a fantastic way to work on your public speaking skills, even if you have zero public speaking experience.
Yeah, that's, for me, that was a big thing, because when I joined Toastmasters, I noticed quite early on that you've got a big range of abilities in the people that are members, right? Some people come there and, you know, they have trouble getting their first words out. They're like sweating, you know, getting on stage. And other people are like, I am a TED speaker. I'm just here to practice more, right? So, yeah, which one of those were you?
Neither nor, actually. I'm certainly not a TED speaker, but I've always been comfortable in front of people. It's not a faith that I'm so good so much as I just don't care. I have this hold my beer attitude, and right, it really works.
Yeah, it's the do it while scared attitude.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's this meme online. I'll see how I can find it and put it in the show notes, which is a little diagram. It's like, I want to do this, but I'm scared. And then the advice is, okay, fine, do it scared. And just so, yeah, I love that.
Just do it. Just get started.
So this is our first recommendation today then for the listeners and viewers on YouTube, is to go check out your nearest Toastmasters club.
That's right. And with the Toastmasters public service announcement out of the way, on with the
show. There we go. We'll do that. So you mentioned that you used to be in the aviation industry until COVID. And so I want to talk about both of those things. And let's before we talk about the impact of COVID, how did you get into the aviation industry?
Was quite literally born into it. My parents were a pilot and flight attendant, the old 1970s love story. They met working trips together, flying for an American, an airline based in the U.S., based in Atlanta, actually. Mm. Well, Delta Airlines, to be specific. I grew up in the Atlanta area. They flew for Delta for 30 years each. And the running joke in my family that I'm not entirely sure was a joke was that my first word as a child was airplane.
It may or may not be true.
But I've always been in love with everything that has wings. I'm actually a private pilot myself. I had grandparents who were private pilots. It really is a family business. And yeah, I just loved it. And so it wasn't my first job, actually. My first job was as a consultant right out of my MBA. But at the first available opportunity, when I got tired of consulting, I dove into the airline industry and didn't look back until COVID.
Man, I want to ask you about getting out of consulting because that's something that I did myself. But because you mentioned that you're a private pilot, you like to fly planes. I like to jump out of planes. I feel like we gotta combine this at some point.
Well, there's a saying among pilots that no pilot ever jumps out of a plane with a perfectly functional engine.
Yeah, exactly. And so for me, of course, I love to jump out of planes with perfectly functional engines. That's my latest hobby, skydiving. So
looks like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. I highly recommend it to everybody. You know, at least if you've never done it, go do one of those tandem jumps where you're hooked up to an instructor and they sort of like, it's one of those things where you just got to do it while scared, you know?
Exactly right.
I was terrified the first time I did it. I mean, I barely remember my first jump, so...
That's a fear I have yet to get over.
Yeah. Well, you know, ask someone to give it to you for like a meaningful birthday or something like that. So
noted.
There you go.
Excellent.
So you said you're in management consulting. Was that sort of straight out of college?
So actually, I did a bit of wandering around out of my undergrad and worked for the state government in Florida. Spent a little bit of time just kind of traveling around Europe, taking language lessons in Germany. And did my MBA kind of early. I did my MBA at 20. I started at 24, finished at 26, which was great from a cost and get it out of the way perspective. I think it would have been more beneficial if I had more work experience. But I think, as most people who have MBAs will tell you, the MBA is not really an education; it's a credential and a network.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I actually got into management consulting on the back of the MBA. It was an international program, and I had an exchange semester in Germany. And what I really wanted to do was get on at Lufthansa or Air Berlin, which was then still an airline. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to get an internship at either of those. But one of my professors was an alumnus of a German consulting firm based out of Stuttgart. And he said, look, my old firm is looking for an American to help us with our one-man Boston office. How do you feel about an internship based in Stuttgart but helping our Boston-based partner? I said, let's do it. So the three-month internship turned into a six-month internship, turned into... about a year and a half of management consulting. It was, I had fantastic colleagues. Probably the best mentor I ever had was at that consulting firm. I still occasionally am in touch with him today, but it was 95% travel, mostly across the Atlantic. I was doing 2 weeks in the US, 2 weeks in Germany, and I was exhausted. And my then fiance, now ex-wife, and I were starting to get serious about getting together, and I didn't want to make her a work widow, so I said, look, I'm going to drop the consulting thing and move back to the States. And I moved back to the States and found a job at Lufthansa's, ironically, America's office in New York, and I was off to the races in my airline career.
Wow. Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there, and I'd like to get into some of those things in a bit more detail. Because first of all, what was it like to fly all the time for work? Just because you said you were away for 2 weeks at a time?
Yeah, it would be 2 weeks at a time. Yeah, it was. Well, it would be 2 weeks at a time, but it would be usually 2 weeks on, 1 week off was kind of the rhythm to it. And at some, there were some stages where it was 2 weeks on, 2 days off. I mean, it was just ping-ponging back and forth. And the thing that made it really hard was the firm that I worked for only paid for business class travel if you were a principal or a partner. And I was just an analyst. Ooh. And so I was going across the Atlantic every 2 weeks in economy, which is utterly, I mean, okay, when you're on vacation, fine. But when you're doing it every 2 weeks for business and they expect you to work on the day of arrival, it's just exhausting.
Yeah. Oh, working on the day of arrival, that sounds awful. Yeah.
Even eastbound, yeah. And it's like, guys, you got to be kidding me. I've had maybe 2 hours of sleep on this plane.
Right. You're probably not very effective. No,
total zombie.
Yeah. How did you end up actually getting stuff done around that time? Did you just power through, or did you sort of like those days when you showed up early in the morning, so you just kind of do the bare minimum, wait for a good night's sleep, try and catch up the next day?
A lot of coffee, a lot of trying to answer emails, trying not to make mistakes, looking at the same PowerPoint five times in a row to make sure I hadn't screwed it up again or make sure I'd found all the mistakes. Because when you write PowerPoints and you're half asleep, they're bound to be full of errors. And yeah, so it was just a lot of iteration, a lot of trying to double check myself. And I was so busy that I didn't even really have time. I'm embarrassed to say this, especially on this program, but I'm embarrassed to say I didn't really have the time to implement a proper productivity system. Right. And I think it would have made it a lot easier if I had been able to borrow a Franklin Covey term, sharpen my saw, before continuing.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that in a few minutes, you know, whether you're using any tools right now, but I'm interested in this background story because, you know, personally, I also spent some time working in consulting, and thinking back to it now, I'm also like, well, yeah, I worked a lot of hours and I could have done a lot better, but hey, I was young, you know, you were young at the time. And so you learn from it, and you spent some time in consulting, and then you got into the airline industry. So how did that jump happen?
Well, the jump happened just by sheer force of will. There was no way I was not going to work for an airline when I finally decided to get out of consulting. I'd been dreaming about it since childhood. And when I was starting to get tired of consulting, there were days or nights I would sit in the hotel or in the airport surfing airliners.net, which is a famous aviation bulletin board, and going, what am I doing here? Why am I not working for an airline?
Yeah.
And so when the opportunity presented itself, to change careers, I said, you know what? This is the way I've always wanted to go. Let's do it. And I just kept knocking on doors until I found somebody to hire me.
And you ended up being a consultant in the airline industry, but you probably didn't start there, I would think.
No, definitely not. So I worked for three airlines in the U.S. I worked for Boeing, the aircraft manufacturer out of Seattle. And then I was actually working for an airline down in New Zealand. And I, between Boeing and Air New Zealand, I had taken a previous role as a consultant or as a solo consultant, although at that time it was working more with investors and suppliers to aircraft manufacturers. But that was really kind of it was a very difficult year. And when Air New Zealand reached out about the role, it was a no-brainer for me to take it. They had seen some of my writing and somebody reached out and said, hey, we have this role. We think you're a good fit. If you're interested, throw in an application. I did, and off I went. But when I was hired for the role down in New Zealand, they brought me in for a new... So my background is in what's called revenue management, which is pricing and demand forecasting, and which I'm sure we'll get to a little bit later on. But the airline brought me in to be the strategist behind a new revenue management system that they were using. And when I started with the airline, they said, okay, this is a 3-month implementation, and after that, we're going to be up and running. Well, I left in month 34 of the implementation.
Month 34 of the 3-month
Month 34.
Implementation.
Yeah. And they didn't even really finish it until about 2 months into COVID, when the airline was flying like 5 flights a week across the entire network. Yeah. And so I had lovely colleagues. I had great bosses, but I had had enough of watching my career go nowhere. And I knew that my career progression was largely held up by the rollout of the system. And I said, lovely to meet you. It's been fun, but enough's enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'd been contacted about doing some consulting, ironically for another aircraft manufacturer and for another airline. And I said, it's now or never. So I took the leap and off I went into solo consulting the second time, working with airlines and aircraft manufacturers. By the reason aircraft manufacturers came into the picture is because my background isn't just revenue management. It's also aircraft fleet planning, which airplanes we're going to fly, and network planning, where are we going to fly and with how much capacity. And manufacturers need someone with an airline perspective to come in and help them make sure that their products are connecting with the customers,
the
with
demand.
The airline customers. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I had a phenomenal I left the airline in early 2019. 2019 was a blowout year. I ended up going to Ukraine for about 6 months. I ended up actually back in New Zealand as a consultant. And when COVID hit, I was in Singapore and getting ready to start commuting between Japan and the Philippines for about another 6 months, and it all collapsed within the same 2 or 3 weeks in February 2020.
Right, yeah. I want to get there in a second, but first, something I've been really curious about is you worked in a management consulting job in the U.S., then you worked for Boeing, was that in Seattle? Yeah.
That's right.
And then you moved to New Zealand.
Yep.
Did you encounter very different work cultures between the U.S. and New Zealand, or perhaps between Boeing and Air New Zealand?
Absolutely. Boeing is a very special animal for a number of reasons. But I would say the U.S. versus New Zealand is really the contrast that I would want to draw. And I remember one time early in my my time at Air New Zealand that I had a presentation and a call with our London office that I was responsible for organizing, and both of them were due on the same day. And so I stayed in the office until 8, 9, 10 o'clock, three nights in a row to get it done. And on the night before, we had a team pub quiz night. And so I went out with the team to did the pub quiz thing and came back and worked until probably about 10:30. Woke up Friday, did the call, did the presentation, all went well. But around, I don't know, 3-4 o'clock that afternoon, my manager pulled me into a privacy room and said, "Nice work, no complaints, but how did you get all that done?" And I said, "Well, I was here until 8, 9, 10 o'clock. And he goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, mate, we don't do that here. You should have asked for more time." And I said, "You should have asked for... I thought you spoke English in New Zealand. Hang on."
I think they sort of speak English in New Zealand, right?
Right. These words sound like English, right, but I'm really not sure I understand the concept that's coming out of your mouth here. You should have asked for more time. Yeah, that was mind-blowing. But it ended up working out because, you know, the work-life balance was really nice, and it was quite a contrast from my corporate roles previously, and especially from management consulting. Now, when you're doing solo consulting, it's a bit of a different animal because it's punishment that you choose for yourself.
Yeah.
As I tell people, I'm the CEO, the chief everything officer.
Right.
Marketing, finance, accounting, tax, it's all me.
Customer support,
you can
customer service.
That's right. Yeah. You can outsource some things, but only to a point.
Right.
And so there's always work to be done. So if I wake up even on a Saturday or a Sunday, work's on my mind. And I'm asking myself, should I go do leisure activity X, or should I maybe do a little bit of work today? And that tension never goes away.
Right, right. And let's go there then, because that's an interesting topic for me also, because I've been working for myself for quite a while. And you know, I've had my business for maybe 5-6 years now, and very slowly I'm adding someone. You know, I have a video editor now, and, you know, perhaps I'm going to have someone edit the podcast, but still mostly me. And I also come from a consulting background, and it's very different, right? If you have a job like, well, consulting, I think, is a special sort of thing, because often you don't turn off, especially like you and me, we both worked in consulting in the US, different culture perhaps than in New Zealand or, you know, Europe where we live now. But yeah, that thing where you're working for yourself, and it's like every day is Monday, or every day is Wednesday, or every day is Sunday. It's all the same to me.
They all blur together, absolutely.
Yeah, so did you find it difficult to go from, okay, work is done, you can shut off, now this is personal time, to this situation where you have to make this decision sort of, you know, moment by moment, are you going to do any work now or not?
Oh, absolutely. I still struggle with it. I mean, I now have fairly good tools for setting priorities, but just because the priorities are done doesn't mean that all of the non-priority admin doesn't need to get done.
Yeah.
And so the question is, you know, if I get to 3 p.m. on a Friday, or if I wake up on Saturday morning, what do I do? You know, do I have time to read The Economist, or do I need to go do that admin, you know, those expenses that I haven't submitted yet, or those emails from my accountant that I haven't paid attention to, or, you know, the admin things that are, they're not customer critical, they're not burning platforms, but if you don't put out those fires, they will come to haunt you eventually.
Yeah. How do you decide what to work on any given day?
So I have a whiteboard, and the whiteboard has my, I'm sure you're aware of the book, The One Thing. And I start with my one thing that's on the whiteboard, and then I've got below that what I call cake toppers. So what are what's the icing on the cake? What are the cake toppers? Those are the bonus things that, you know, once the one thing is done, what are the other things that I'd like to get to? And every day is like drinking from a fire hose. It's like, which things am I going to let drop today? It's not even a question of which things. There is the what do I most need to get done, but what I most need to get done naturally entails I can procrastinate that another day.
Yeah,
I don't like that because I'm used to tying off things, leaving with an empty inbox. I'm not used to just letting everything hang out.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've been reflecting on a lot lately is that you can never finish every single task on your to-do list, right? And you can make, of course, a shorter to-do list, but the true to-do list of all of the things that are worth doing in your life is functionally infinite, right? And so
that's right. That's right.
You get into this situation where if you measure your success by the length of your remaining, you know, to-dos on the to-do list, you're going to lose. You're going to lose every single day for the rest of your life, right? So
absolutely.
I prefer to do it the other way around, right? And be like, oh, this is something I accomplished. And for me, I find it helpful to do a weekly review where I take a quick look at what did I accomplish last week. I've also, for at least a year now, I've been doing daily journaling, and that helps a lot too. Just maybe 10 minutes in the morning, I sort of do it before I talk to anybody, you know, before I even get, you know, leave the bedroom. And I'm just writing down, you know, what's on my mind. And often that's things that I accomplished. Yeah. And just taking a quick look back, I'm actually accomplishing more than you think. So for you, do you have any sort of reflective practice like that?
I do a weekend wrap, or excuse me, an end of week wrap up. And I don't do what you're doing. I actually really like that idea of writing an accomplishment journal, I think you almost could call it. I really like that, but that's not what I'm doing. For me, it's writing down what are the top priorities, just kind of brain dumping everything right. that didn't get finished from this week yeah. so that I can launch into the following week with a sense of clarity and knowing what's top of my agenda.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that you have a lot of responsibilities, right? We'll talk a little bit about what your current business is about in a minute. But you're running your own business right now. It's sort of a consulting sort of thing, right? And yeah. you're the chief everything officer. So how do you decide sort of which business things to work on today? You said you're going to pick one thing, right? That's like your most important thing. Yep. And it sounds like you do it early in the day. You're eating that frog, you know, for people who know that
reference.
That's right. Yep. But you still got to decide what the frog is for today. What is the one thing? So some people will do like day theming, right? They're like, oh, Mondays are for, you know, content creation. And Tuesdays are for admin. And Wednesdays are for this. Do you have any habits there? Or is it just whatever feels most urgent to you?
I try to start with a weekly theme, and then within the weekly theme, I'll break that down into daily top priorities.
So what's your weekly theme for like this week?
For this week, it's actually finishing a website overhaul that needs doing and getting a podcast of my own launched.
Oh, exciting.
That's going to be... Yeah, it'll be both are not. We'll talk about where to find me at the end. But the podcast has the same name as my business, The Scale Whisperer. And by the time this episode airs, it'll be available everywhere that you can find how I get stuff done.
Exciting! That's exciting. And so we're definitely going to talk about that. So you say this week I'm going to get my website up. You know, I'm going to get my podcast launched. How does that translate to what you're working on day to day? Does that go on? Do you have like a weekly thing on your whiteboard? Was it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Yep. So there's a weekly thing, just a full week. What is this week's theme? Like, for instance, if I'm looking right now, it says this week's sprint, website plus podcast. And today, the focus is really website because I just got back the latest edits from my web developer. They're ready to go. And so I'm actually just writing content for the website today, looking for graphics to fill in some holes that need to be filled. And then that'll probably continue through tomorrow. And depending on how the week goes, ideally, I would like to switch over to the podcast by Wednesday afternoon. But if that doesn't happen, then it'll be Thursday. And Thursday, Friday, I'll work on the podcast.
Yeah. So a lot of people like to do things this way. I should say a lot of people that I speak to or people who take some of my courses, you know, they, especially the people that have their own businesses or that are self-employed, because we have a lot of flexibility with our time, right? If you have a job, often your boss is saying, I need you to do this week. So you have much less of a choice. So personally, I don't do anything like this. I don't really do any like theming of what my week is going to be about or my day is going to be about, because what I find is that I'm actually really bad at predicting how long things are going to take. So
yeah.
If I say, you know what, this week I'm going to work on my podcast, and next week I want to work on that. Maybe it takes me only 2 days to work on the podcast, or maybe it takes me a week and a half, and then I have to adjust. And so I try to do a little bit of planning ahead. You know, okay, you and I are having a conversation today. Obviously, I prepared for this conversation, yeah. Made sure to, you know, do that on time. And similarly, you know, I just launched a new course. Okay, I kind of had an idea. I wanted to launch it in February of 2024. But I find that I don't like to go too far beyond that. So for you, if you say, well, I want to get my website launched this week, what if it doesn't happen by the end of the week? You know, how do you feel about that? And what do you do with the other things you scheduled for the week?
So that's the reason I have the one thing and then the icing on the cake and the cake toppers is so I've got things that can be deferred. I have to get the one thing done. That's the non-negotiable.
What happens if you don't get it done?
Then it rolls into tomorrow and it becomes or it stays the number one thing for tomorrow. Okay. And whatever I had hoped tomorrow's thing was going to be becomes the first icing on the cake.
I see.
Yeah. And that's so the icing on the cake and cake toppers metaphor is something that I borrow from the 6-Minute Success Journal, if you've heard
no,
of that.
I haven't,
that's
no.
a book by a German author. Mm. It's really good. And so I basically end up just having to make today's top to do, tomorrow's top to do, and then everything else gets subordinated below that.
Yeah. So you're sort of always, if you don't finish it tomorrow, I'm going to keep working on it. It's always...
Unless something more urgent comes up. I mean, obviously, I check my inboxes a couple of times a day. And if something comes through that is a true burning platform issue, or especially if it's a client question, if it's a client question, that gets top billing no matter what. So I'm responding to clients, and then the internal priorities get bumped below that. But as long as there are no client priorities, then I'll just continue down the same path.
Yeah. So do you know Cal Newport?
Of course.
Yeah, Cal Newport, who wrote the book Deep Work. He's a big fan of time blocking. Some people call this time boxing, where what you do is you're literally taking your calendar. It can be a paper calendar or a digital calendar, and you say, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. tomorrow, I'm going to work on this particular task or project. You know, from 4 to 5:30, I'm going to work on this other thing, and so on. Do you do anything like that?
Funny you should ask. I actually have the time block planner.
Well, there we go.
Here.
For those of you who are listening to the audio version, Justin was holding up a notebook. So.
Yep. And this is actually by Cal Newport. It's a tool that he created in line with his teachings. And I'm going to flip to some blank pages. And you can actually see for... Week 9, day 4, I think that says. What are the time blocks and what am I going to do in each of these
time
blocks?
So you use this. You bought it, but you also use it. Okay.
I do. And I love it. This was actually, I got started on it because of a productivity coach I was working with last year who really introduced me to some great tools. And I would say Time Block Planner is top of the stack in terms of helpful tools.
Yeah. When did you start?
So I've been really grateful.
Sometime last year?
I started with that about 6 months ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you find changed for you?
I found that I was more focused. I found that I was able to actually say, okay, this is, having said that things roll from day to day, if I've got two things that are burning platform issues in a day, or if I've got client work on top of my one thing, then I'll say, okay, from 9 until 11 this morning, I'm going to work on the client issue. And then from 11 till 12, I'll work on, in this case, the website. I'm going to go to the lunch. I'm going to go for lunch at 12. I'm going to go to the gym at 1. And then from 2 until 5 or 6, I'm going to keep working on the website. But it gives me finite blocks of time in keeping with the time block system that I'm going to dedicate to this task and this task alone. And I find it improves my focus. I find it improves my clarity. And it improves my ability to put it down.
Yeah.
And to really take kind of an 80-20 approach to things and say, look, I don't have all day. I can't boil the ocean on this. What's the 80-20 that I can get done in 2 hours?
Right. I find it fascinating that you mentioned this because I personally have really mixed feelings about this method. So on the one hand, decision fatigue is real. And especially for people who are working by themselves or, you know, have their own business, there's 1,000 responsibilities that you have, you know, 1,000 things you could do. It can help a lot. You know, ahead of time to say, this is what I want to work on today. This is, of course, why I'm such a big fan of to-do lists and using proper task management apps. There's a difference between making a to-do list for today and putting all that stuff on your calendar and giving it a specific time, right? So if I say I'm going to record a video today, it's a sponsored video for YouTube, I'm recording that today, you know, I'm doing some other things, okay. But if I say I'm going to do it from 1 to 3, sometimes I find that I'm super tired. You know, I just had like a terrible night's sleep and it doesn't feel right to do it. Or sometimes I find that it takes me much longer than I thought. And so if I schedule some, I've tried this before. I've tried, you know, let's work on the script for this video or outline of this video, do the research from 1 to 3. Now it's 3 p.m. I'm still very happily working on that. I'm really in the zone. You know, I'm in that state of flow. I'm really productive. I don't want to stop. I want to take advantage of it because I don't always feel in the zone, you know, in that state of flow. So Do you always listen to your plan? If you're like working very happily, you're just like, okay, time's up.
I try to make it my default. I'm not going to tell you that I do it 100%. I have days that I'm just not with it. I'm not focused. Now, again, if it's a client issue, then, and this really is a lesson I learned from my consulting days or my big firm consulting days. If it's a client issue, I have to muddle through and get it done no matter what, because I've made a promise to a client and I can't break that. But if it's something internal, if I'm having a day where I'm just off, I will get out and go for a longer walk than usual. Right. I might go to the gym. I might read a book. I might find some other diversion just and let my brain relax, because your brain is a muscle and you can fatigue it just like any other muscle. Yeah. And so I have to let the muscle relax and have a little bit of rest. And there have been days, honestly, Peter, that I've just had to say around 11 or 12 o'clock, this isn't my day. I'm done. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I've had those days as well. And I am actually a big fan of this type of self-care, and of trusting also that if you take a day off, what I think happens for a lot of people is they have this sense that I'm not feeling it today. If I allow myself to just not do it and continue work tomorrow, now I'm going to be lazy. That means I'm lazy. Right. And so it's going to happen all the time. Half my days are going to be like this. And I think for most people, this is not the case. But I think it does require some trust in yourself that if you put this down for today, you know, does that say anything about you in the future?
I don't believe it says anything about me. What I worry about is, does it say anything about my ability to finish this particular task?
Yeah.
I find myself asking, am I just bored with this? Right. Am I just tired of it? Am I really going to come back and give this the effort it deserves?
Yeah. Well, that's where I like the 80-20 approach that you mentioned. You know, what I usually call this is just like good enough. So it's actually one of the exercises that I have people do in one of my courses. This is my favorite way to break through procrastination, right? We all deal with procrastination sometimes. And this is exactly the problem you're describing, is that there's something is off about this task. And I start asking myself, okay, like, what is the, like, crappy version of this? You know, if this particular project I'm having trouble with, or task or whatever, what is clearly a not good enough product at the end? And then what is like the perfect situation, right? And I'm like, okay, well, I don't want to deliver something crappy. I don't have the energy to make something quote unquote perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but you know, very, very close to perfect. And then I sort of ask myself, what would sit right in the middle? What is sort of acceptable and will do the job? And usually that actually lets me bust through. So I don't know if you ever tried anything like this.
I try to start with a skeleton of what the minimum viable product is, so to speak, and work through the MVP. And then depending on how much time and or energy I've got left, add on to the MVP. But I really try to start with a clear notion of what is the MVP for this particular output and get to that level and reevaluate.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. People should do that. I want to talk about one particular productivity habit that I think you have, because I did a little research on you before we chatted today, and I found something online where you wrote about using voice memos, especially when you're attending conferences or something like that. Yes. Do you want to tell people what you do? What is the problem you encounter, and what is your technique here?
So I'm not a good multitasker, and I can listen to you or I can take notes. I can't really do both. Mm. So especially if I'm at a trade show and I want to have a conversation, and trade shows and conferences are great for gathering intel, for meeting prospects, for hearing about actual problems that potential clients have. And I want to be fully present in those conversations. Right. But I also don't want to look like a journalist with a microphone in your face. And I mean, that's just socially awkward. Yeah. And so what I'll do as a compromise is I will be fully present in the conversation. And as soon as the conversation's over, I walk away. It's somewhere well clear of the person I was just having a conversation with. And I do not have another conversation until I've pulled out my phone or previously a voice recorder and brain dump as much as I can remember about who I spoke with, what we talked about, what the key takeaways are, any follow-ups that are required. Yeah. And then I will actually throw that recording into my favorite transcription tool, TurboScribe. And TurboScribe comes back with a transcript, and I drop that into my task management app.
Yeah. So
yeah, and
I've never heard of TurboScribe. I've heard of this thing called Otter.ai. Have you used that?
Yeah, I have used Otter. Okay. Otter is a good way to... Otter used to be better, in my opinion, okay. but Otter's quality has been eclipsed by other tools over time. And so for recording voice, or excuse me, for recording video calls, I use a tool called Fathom, which is actually free for individual users. And for everything else, I use TurboScribe. And I find that the transcription quality is light years better than Otter, unfortunately.
Okay, that's cool. TurboScribe. Yeah. I'll have to check that out. I love this.
It's well worth it.
Yeah, I just love this technique. I want to share something about how I use this, but there's something that you mentioned that I want to ask you about. First is, you said it gets transcribed and you take that transcript and you put it in your task manager. Tell me a bit more about that. What mechanically, how does that work, and what do you do with the transcript?
I mean, I simplify the process. I'm going through the transcript and I'm copying and pasting lines of text and dropping those as individual tasks in the task manager. So it's a slightly more manual process than I initially let on. Usually end of day, in the worst case, end of the second day. Just while things are still fresh in my mind, I don't want to forget the details of conversations.
Right.
And so my task manager of choice is TickTick, and I'll go into TickTick and I'll create items, I'll create reminders. And a lot of times the things that need to be done are not even for the same week. I don't need to do them while I'm at the conference or at the event. I just need to do it maybe the following week or in a couple of weeks if it's something research related. If it's following up with a new connection, then yeah, it's something I'm going to do probably end of that week.
Yeah.
But I'm setting time specific reminders for everything that I know that I need to do on the back of this particular conversation.
Right. And fairly soon after you have this conversation, you do this processing.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm often talking to people about this in the context of meeting notes, you know, so people are taking meetings, whether it's, you know, at work or, but I personally, this is what I was going to say, I do this when I'm like having coffee with someone for the first time just to get to know someone. Afterwards, I usually don't do this in a voice memo, but I'm going to check out this app because I really like, if anybody who's actually my friend sort of knows this, you know, I love sending voice messages, so you're going to get those from me a lot. I know that some apps will now actually transcribe voice messages, which I hope will soon arrive in WhatsApp and Apple Messages and stuff, because that'll be very helpful for people.
It'd be very helpful, absolutely. But for now, I'm trying to use the best tool that I'm aware of to do the job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I don't want to have to go back and listen to the recording and go, oh, did it transcribe it correctly? And unfortunately, with older generation tools like Otter, there's a lot more manual re-listening and editing.
You just want to be, of course, reading the transcript is much easier. And so... Yeah, I like to do this after I have coffee with someone, you know, just write down some of the key things about that they mentioned about their life. So that next time I meet them and be like, hey, by the way, last time you were struggling with this, how are you doing about that? And it's one of my favorite things to do, because the next time I meet someone, they're like, oh, wow, it's amazing that you remember that. And I'm like, yes, my memory is amazing.
Could we describe this as a friendship CRM?
Friendship CRM. Yeah. I try to keep it very lightweight, Judson, because I don't want to go too far on this, because that's just difficult.
Yeah, of course.
You know, the system maintenance becomes too much. But I love this. And so it's the same thing in the context of a work meeting, you know, whether it's a Zoom meeting, in-person meeting, whatever. Take a few minutes, you know, ideally right after the meeting, to just jot down some stuff. And it can be a voice memo, just then periodically process that stuff, turn it into tasks, you know. I love that habit. So thanks for sharing that.
My pleasure.
Let's switch gears here a little bit, because we mentioned that you were in management consulting first, then you worked in the airline industry until COVID. So... Yep. COVID obviously had a big impact on the airline industry. And so you then transitioned into your current business called the Scale Whisperer, right?
Yes. There was a little bit of a longer path to get there. I've gone through a couple of other iterations, but what I'm doing now is the Scale Whisperer.
And so how did you decide to make this pivot?
Yeah. So... I've done B2B consulting, first obviously with airlines and aircraft manufacturers, but also with cargo carriers for a bit during the pandemic.
Cargo carriers, like bulk ships or
companies like Maersk, like DHL, companies that move goods by air, sea, road, and rail. Trying to help them with actually the kind of same challenges that passenger airlines have: pricing, passenger or customer segmentation, offer optimization, et cetera. And I decided that this time out, I didn't want to do B2B anymore. It's certainly, there is a lot of money to be made in B2B, but it's also, it can be very difficult to break into new industries. And unfortunately, airline consulting is just now, 4 years later, starting to come back.
Yeah.
But it's still a fraction of what it was. But it's hard to be a credible consultant to companies if you haven't worked directly in their industry.
Yeah.
And so I said, between that and the fact that I didn't want to have to charge by the day, I didn't want to have to spend weeks in a client office. I wanted to really run my business on my terms. I decided to pivot to more of a B2C, or what I'm calling now a B2E niche, which is business to entrepreneur. Mm. And my thesis is this: the same kind of pricing and customer segmentation and offer optimization savvy that airlines have and other travel industry companies have can exist for people who run solo and small expertise-based businesses. And that's actually a lot of what powers what we call the creator economy. Yeah. It's people taking their existing expertises and turning them into a business. But instead of charging by the hour, instead of trying to just simply replace their old salary, I want to teach more intelligent ways of pricing. I want to teach people how to segment their customers, how to deliver more value to their customers, but also extract a larger share of that value for themselves.
Yeah. And this pricing value experience that you have is from your work in the airline industry, essentially.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because airlines are constantly trying to price for the customer and for the nature of the flight. Is this a Monday morning or a Saturday midday flight? Those have two very different prices. Is this a flight to Orlando where Disney World is?
Monday morning?
Monday morning, because it's the business traveler. Yeah, because the person who's traveling for business, well, not solo people like you and me, but people who are who work for a larger enterprise, right, they're traveling on somebody else's dollar.
Yeah.
And so they have a much greater willingness to pay than the person who's spending their own dollars.
I always love spending other people's money, you know?
We all do, of course. Yeah, and so when you're traveling on somebody else's dollar, you have a willingness to take a flight at a peak time. You're not going to connect through two cities to get there. You're not going to put up with the same hassles and discomforts and inconveniences that you would when you're traveling by yourself for yourself. Yeah, and so airlines have really gotten it down to a science. Who is the customer? What is the flight? When is this flight? Where are they going? How can we create a package of services? How can we create an experience that taps this person's willingness to pay? It's why you now have not only four different cabins on a long-haul flight, first, business, premium economy, and economy, yeah, but you've got multiple fare products within each cabin.
Right.
So a person traveling on a long-haul flight, in theory, could have up to 12 different choices. Yeah. And that's just for that one flight. I don't want to create that level of complication for the solo provider, because right, that's more than anyone can manage. But the same techniques, knowing who the customer is, identifying their willingness to pay, packaging your services, changing up your pricing, can be done at the individual level, at the small business level. And this is what I want to inculcate. On the bookcase behind me, there are multiple books that have been written on the topic of what's called value-based pricing, which is when you work directly with the client to determine how much impact this is going to make and pricing your service in a way that taps some of the value you're creating.
Yeah.
So if I come to you, Peter, and I say, I'm going to help you with pricing for your courses. I think you've got some opportunity. I think you're maybe leaving a little bit of money on the table. I can help you with this. And for your first year after we work together, if I can improve your revenue per transaction by 5%, then I want 1% of that. Mm-hmm. If I can improve it by 15%, I want 3%
of
that.
Right.
So that it does two things, actually. It allows me to capture more revenue than if I were just billing you by the hour, but it also ties my incentives directly to yours.
Right.
Because if you're paying me by the hour to help you, I can sandbag this project out ad infinitum. This could turn into a 5,000-hour project before you go, wait a second, I didn't sign up for 5,000 hours.
Yes.
But if we price this based on value, if we price this based on what I'm going to do for you in dollars, then you're getting a price that you know is fair, and you're getting a much higher certainty on your return on investment.
Right. And so what would be an example of the sort of service provider that you're working with in this new business?
Yeah. So one of my initial clients is a health coach based in the UK. Mm. He had kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. Mm. And he had moved eventually to three different tiers of service, but the price spreads between each tier of service were a lot smaller than they should have been. And when we talked, he said, well, I've got all these, he focuses on entrepreneurs. And he said, Judson, I've got all these entrepreneurs out of Dubai and Abu Dhabi who are clamoring for my service. And I, when they tell me what they're working in, I mean, these are millionaires that I'm talking to and I'm charging them $300 a month.
Right.
And I went, let me help you. This is an opportunity. You're leaving money on the table. Exactly. Yeah. And so we looked at what his packages were and we said, what are the features of his offerings that offered the most value to customers? How did he automate their fitness processes? How did he help them to become healthier, leaner, fitter, stronger in less time? And we broke those out into multiple tiers and we said, okay, this is a mostly automated tier that you can offer to students and single parents. And this is a tier that you can offer to a mid-career professional. And this is a tier that you can offer to the high rollers from Dubai.
Right.
And his revenue has gone up nearly 50% since I started working with him.
Fantastic.
And he, of course, is thrilled.
That's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. I love value-based pricing. You know, like, you know, helping people to do this, it makes so much sense. It's sometimes difficult to do it. I think culturally it's sometimes difficult. You know, a very good friend of mine is in the sort of litigation, like forensic litigation industry, and that's tough. You know, like lawyers and clients, they expect to be billed by the hour. And it's just, that's just the way that is. And if you're like, you know what, I think we can do better than this, they're like, that's weird. I'll go with someone else. Do you ever hear people complain about that? That it's just difficult to do this?
I have. And what I've said is, one, if that's the pushback you're getting, then you're not messaging the client value well enough. You're not explaining why it's valuable to the client and why it's a better approach for the client. And point number two, if after explaining to the client why it's better for them, they still want to stick with hourly pricing, you need to find a new client.
Yeah.
Because I think one of your previous guests was Jonathan
That's
Stark,
right.
the ditching hourly guy. And Jonathan does some amazing work. He's really kind of focused more on the IT space, but he's done some amazing work in terms of explaining why telling clients that this project is going to take 500 hours and then it turns into a 2,000 hour project because of some unseen glitch is actually a dramatically worse customer experience, and it's less likely to make the customer, even if they're thrilled with your work, refer other clients to you in the future.
Right.
Whereas if you come in and you say upfront, look, whether it takes me 500 hours or 5,000 hours is my problem, not yours. The risk resides with me.
Yeah.
The client may balk at the price initially, but they will never complain at knowing that they can pick up the phone and call you and ask questions or say, hey, Judson, this bug cropped up that I wasn't expecting in some corner of the envelope case. And I know that you will be there to answer the phone and not bill me another hour to fix this issue that should have been fixed in the initial implementation.
Yeah, I always think of my accountants. You know, I have accountants, bookkeepers, and they always charge me by the hour. But the services that they're doing for me are pretty standard. You know, they'll file my income tax return every year. They're filing my VAT, my value-added tax returns every quarter and so on. And I'm always wondering, like, why don't you guys just have me pay, like, a fixed price every year? You know, like, and then they'll send me the specification of hours worked. And, like, I really don't care. Like, I really do not care which of your employees worked how many hours. Like, I just want my taxes to get done, you know? And so, I think it's just a cultural thing a lot of the time.
Well, it's funny you mentioned this because actually I'm working with an accountancy here in Amsterdam that actually does do a monthly
subscription. Oh, really? Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. I think the owner of the firm is a disciple of one of the architects of accountancy, value-based pricing, a guy named Ron Baker. And they actually, they're the only one I'm aware of in the Dutch market anyway, that does this monthly concept. And so everything that's within their normal scope of work, the things you mentioned, the income tax return, the VAT return, all of that's covered as normal work. And I pay a monthly fee. And if I have any questions, if something unusual arises, if there's a bug in their expense software, whatever, I can get them on the phone and it's no additional charge to me. It's included.
Yeah. You just have to have a really good agreement ahead of time about what's included.
Exactly.
But I think that's super important anyway. You know, like I feel like either way, if we're going to be working together, we should have that conversation of what exactly is within the scope and what is not in the scope.
That's right. Because otherwise scope creep takes over. And if you're billing by the hour, scope creep penalizes the customer, and if you're on a value base or a fixed fee arrangement, scope creep penalizes you.
Right.
So somebody loses. And to really have a well-defined scope of work, I think is essential.
Yeah. So one of the things you said just a few minutes ago is if you get a call from a client and you've agreed to do the work for X price, right? A fixed price, a value-based price, you're not charging them to like respond to the client or whatever.
Never.
That's all included. How does that impact your productivity and focus, though? So do you let clients sort of call you anytime, you know, WhatsApp you anytime?
So I do. It depends on the nature of the client. Mm. Because I'm working mostly with other solopreneurs, they work flexible hours like me, and so they understand that I'm not going to pick up the phone. Yeah. They have similar situations,
right? But when you're working with like the CEO of a slightly bigger company, and maybe they're paying you a bit more, maybe they're kind of expecting you to pick up the phone a bit faster.
I don't ever pick up the phone in real time ever.
Yeah, me neither. Unless it's
Yeah, if it's a prearranged call, if you call me or if you email me and say, hey, listen, I need to run something by you. Can I call you at 9 o'clock? I'm going to be on the phone at 9 o'clock. You can count on it. But other than that, I don't take calls spontaneously. And I actually depend on WhatsApp with some of the clients that I work with. It's actually something that I learned from a fitness coach that I've worked with who said, hey, listen, I will be available to you during daylight hours 7 days a week. Now, I don't do 7 days a week. I do 5 days a week. My clients know that they can message me anytime with any kind of question. And I'm not super strict about the hours. If I'm sitting on a train or in the doctor's waiting room and I've got 5 minutes to spare and there's a WhatsApp message waiting from one of my clients, I'm going to answer it.
You're going to send him a voice message.
Or even better, a voice memo. If it's a complicated concept, I will. Now, depending on the environment that you're in, that may not be possible. But I also love voice messages because it's easier to explain things with context. My standard that I tell people is I'm going to respond to emails within 2 business days. I'm going to respond to WhatsApp messages within 1 business day. Yeah. But I'm almost always faster than that, and I pride myself on it.
Yeah, and you don't find that this sort of interrupts your focus because you're working on those schedule blocks, and you finish one of the blocks, and then you check your communication, right? You put on Do Not Disturb in the meantime, I think.
That's absolutely right. Like when you and I scheduled this interview, you reached out to me and said, "Hey, I'd like to do I'd like to have you on my podcast." I said, "Great, I do weekday afternoons."
Right.
And you came back and said, "Yeah, no problem. That's because it works for you as well." Afternoons are a little bit less focused time for me. Right. I do anything to avoid morning meetings to the extent possible because that's really my core deep work time. Yeah. To borrow another Cal Newport term. But afternoons, I'm a little bit more flexible and a little bit looser. And so I'm willing to do calls and podcasts and interviews and customer conversations in the afternoon. And in the case of US clients, even the early evening hours.
Yeah.
Cause that's less focused time. But if I'm going to work with a client into the evening hours, I'm probably gonna take a little bit longer midday break so that my brain's a little bit more rested.
I like that. This is a very intentional way to plan your day. And I like this cause I think so many people have just not thought about this, and meetings are whenever, right? And it becomes I find it so hard to switch contexts. If I've just been in a meeting talking about this, I cannot immediately go back to another project. Like, it takes me a little bit of time. You know, that's why earlier when you said you do this sort of time blocking, time boxing kind of thing, I was like, well, what about if you're in the zone? Because I always really try to ride that energy wave, you know.
And messages completely destroy that,
for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to start wrapping up here. You've mentioned a couple of tools, that's not otter.ai, for example, the better one.
TurboScribe. Yep.
Cal Newport's planner and stuff. Is there any other tools in the field of productivity, getting organized, that you really enjoy that you'd like to share with people?
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of TickTick. Mm-hmm. I know that's not one of your courses that you've done.
No, it's not, but people sometimes ask me. They're like, what about TickTick, Peter? What about TickTick? So.
Absolutely, yeah. There is another productivity guru who does YouTube videos, and he's spoken at length about TickTick, and he got me turned on to it. And I said, let me give it a try. And I found it was the most flexible, most comprehensive tool I'd ever worked with. So I love TickTick. That's it. I try not to get overwhelmed with tools.
Good.
The other tool that I will mention, if I dare call it that, is a pack of post-it notes that sit on my bedside
table.
There
you go.
And the only reason that they're there is because I do not sleep with a phone in the bedroom, and I want to have the ability to write down those last minute late night thoughts before I go to bed and just get it purged out of my brain and not have to think about it during the night. Yeah, so that's one. And I'll actually tell you about one more very manual tool is washable crayons for the shower.
Washable crayons for the shower. Okay.
many of us have discovered that while we're in the shower, we have
amazing
thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, because your brain is freed up from other things, and the most random ideas will come to you while you're in the shower. Yeah. And I discovered that a couple of manufacturers actually make washable crayons for the shower. And it's, you basically just take your hand or a mild brush and you can scrub it right off. But what I'll do is, if a thought comes to me in the shower, I'll write it down. I'll take a picture of it with my phone after I've dried off. I'll scrub it off the wall, but I have the thought captured and I don't lose it. So that's my other information or idea capturing tool.
I love this, so and to speak. You know what I also love? This, I think it's recognizable to so many of us, the shower thoughts concept. And yeah. I find that there's so many inputs in our world these days. You know, we don't all have it, but most of us lead lives where there's screens all around. There's, you know, we have conversations with so many different people every day. And to me, I don't think it's anything special about the shower. I have the same thing when I go on a walk. You know, I think it's just sometimes we get so wrapped up in doing stuff all the time that, like, as soon as we don't actually have something to engage with, the brain is like, oh, I have these 15 other ideas. Let me just, like, throw those out there, you know? It happens to me as well during meditating. I'll be meditating, and I'll see all these thoughts popping by, and I'm like, oh! I've learned right now that during meditating, I try not to interrupt it, to write it down, you know? And I sort of develop this trust, this belief that if it's important enough, it will stick around until after the meditation session.
Fair enough.
But I like your analog way of doing that in the shower. I've heard of people who will put, like, waterproof, you know, speakers or you know, like, so you can talk to Amazon, what is it called? Alexa. Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me play the Uno reverse card here and put you on the spot. Sure. When you're out walking, how do you capture your ideas while you're walking without getting engaged with
your phone? Yeah, I do it with my phone. I don't have a good way of doing it without my phone, but I will have my phone on Do Not Disturb. I've got my sort of Apple Watch, and I don't like that to be tapping me on my wrist all the time while I'm on a walk. So I've got it on Do Not Disturb, and I've got on my lock screen of my phone, I have a plus button for my favorite to-do app, which, by the way, which to-do app I use changes all the time because I'm sort of in this interesting situation where I teach people how to use them. And people are always like, Peter, which is your favorite? Like, which app are you using right now? And it changes all the time, you know, because which I don't recommend for anybody else. But whichever app you're using, you know, for example, if I'm using Things or if I'm using OmniFocus, you can put a plus button on the lock screen of your phone. So I pull my phone out of my pocket, I immediately press the plus button, and it goes to open a new task. And then I just write down whatever it is, the thought that I had, then I save that, and then I turn my phone off. So I don't see any other apps. I don't see any messages that I've gotten, because if I open my phone, unlock it, look at my home screen, I'm already seeing 8 notifications from 3 different messaging apps and whatever. I don't want to do that because I want to enjoy my walk. But if you've got a better idea that doesn't involve the phone, let me know. No, actually not.
I've taken all of the social media apps off my phone except LinkedIn, but I've turned off notifications on that. But what I've done is I'm like you. I'll set the phone on Do Not Disturb especially if I'm going to listen to a podcast or if I just want quiet. And sometimes when I walk, I just want quiet.
For sure.
And I love, exactly like you said, the ideas just come bubbling up, and you don't want to let them go. But I do appreciate what you say about meditation, because I've had the same phenomenon, and I have never quite gotten to the same level of peace you have about, well, the idea will stay with me. So maybe I need to learn to relax a bit more on
that. Well, hey, that's what meditation is for, right? In the end, meditation is like, people try to describe meditation in many ways, but definitely one great way of explaining it is just relax. You know, just don't try to control everything all the time.
Defocus the brain.
Exactly. This has been a really fun conversation, Judson. If people were listening, especially, you know, if they were listening to you describe how you help people with your current business, I'd like to know where they can find you. I also will tell everybody right now that you have very fun posts on your LinkedIn, so maybe you want to point people there as well, but I'll leave that up
absolutely
to you.
Yeah, so let me start with LinkedIn. That's a great plug. Thank you. It's Judson Rollins, JudsonRollins, on LinkedIn. There's only one. I'm pretty easy to find. And you can also go to scalewhisperer.com, or you can find the soon-to-come Scale Whisperer podcast. It will be live by the time this episode is. And you can find that everywhere that you find how they get stuff done.
Love it. Thank you very much, Judson, for coming on.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.